This meeting will come to order. Members, please take their seats. Thank you. We do have a quorum, so the first bill on the agenda is HF 1198. It's Carlos Mariani bill. Welcome, Carlos Mariani, representative.
Gracias.
Gracias. It's kind of feel the opposite here today, you know?
Yeah, that's good.
The last time we were meeting, you were on this side of the table, so it helps to share this initiative.
It's a good learning lesson for both of us, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I believe I need a motion to move House File 1198 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the K-12 Finance Committee.
Representative Hillstrom.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will move that House File 1198 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the K-12 Finance Committee.
Representative Hillstrom moves Representative Mariani's bill 1198 and recommends the pass and refer to K-12 Finance. Representative Mariani, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, it's actually technically a pretty simple bill. Would eliminate the current gap of 5 years for accounting for funding for ELL funding and move that up to 7 years. I actually have another bill that just lifts off the cap completely, and that's another approach. And just very quickly, and then I'll ask testifiers to come up. The no cap was actually the standard, if you will, for a number of, I think for many years, maybe all the years in which we've done this kind of funding in the state. And then during the budget crisis years of a few years ago, and a number of members here were present during that time, we entertained a recommendation from the governor to place a five-year cap on this funding. And quite frankly, Mr. Chair, members, we had very little debate. As I recall, I served on K-12 Finance at the time, as so did Representative Greiling, and I believe Representative Heigerken. And we obviously were dealing with a lot of stressful issues, but we really did not have a good policy discussion at that time. A few weeks ago, we had Commissioner Segrin testifying in Representative Greiling's committee, and I raised the issue of the five-year gap. And the commissioner admitted that she thought that 7 years would be a much more acceptable level, because the research at that time, and I think still stands, tells us that if you're going to set a minimum, that this is probably where it needs to be. That position did not prevail during conference committee at that time, and so we wound up with the five-year gap. And I would argue largely driven by the stress and the need to balance out our state budget. Unfortunately, we've done it at the expense of school districts' ability to deliver quality instruction for limited English speakers in their systems. And this bill will at least give them more room to be able to do that. And I believe you'll hear from testifiers today on both the stress that decision created a few years ago, as well as some of the research that tells us that if you're going to set a minimum, it's probably at 7. And quite frankly, members, I think you'll also hear that there really is no one formula to address this issue, that students come to these classrooms, to our systems, at different places. They come at different ages, with different educational experience backgrounds, at different levels of linguistic capabilities in the English language, and depending on their background, and you may be able to do a stellar job in 3 years of ELL services, but in many cases, you're going to need 7 years and even more to be able to do that. So with that, Mr. Chair, members, I'll stop and ask testifiers to come forward and share their information with you and the committee.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. Would you call your testifiers forward, please?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure what order we're going to do this, so I'll just...
I'll leave that up to you.
Look for hands to come up here. So. come on forward, Mr. Ortega from the Minneapolis Public Schools. We're going to do this whole hearing in Spanish.
All right.
Yeah, but Paige can pass that around.
Good morning.
Bienvenido.
Bienvenido.
Welcome. Could you please identify your name for the record?
My name is Luis Ortega with Minneapolis Public Schools.
Welcome again.
Thank you. Committee members, Chair Dominguez. Representative Mariani seems to have taken all my words that I would have used to describe this, but I'll take another stab at it if you don't mind. The letter going around, actually, I started formulating that over 5 years ago when Governor Pawlenty first initiated this cap, and we've wordsmithed some, but you have some good research pieces that you can focus in on. I think I'll attempt to ad-lib a little bit as opposed to reading the letter for you. American education today has been asked to do something that is never done before in the history of public schools, and that is to educate all of our children before the families get into the economy. In other words, our predecessors, our immigrants that came prior to us, were able to get into the economy. They were able to work while their children graduated from high school. Today, that's not the case. Today, we expect our immigrant children to succeed in school before entering the economy. Something like in 1901, the high school dropout rate was high, but the dropout problem was low because people could find jobs in the economy. Today, our dropout problem is actually better, but our dropout problem is high because students need to be educated before they enter the economy. And I will take a moment to read sort of the last paragraph in the letter. Minnesota leaders need to allow English language learners the opportunity to receive more than 5 years of funding in their particular situation. Some of the factors that impact this are, as Carlos Mariani had mentioned already, prior educational background, the type of program that the student has experienced, and the level of preparation that teachers have received. It is clear to me that issues and concerns regarding English language learners have typically been raised with a negative aspect. Little attention or thought has been given across the board that recognizes the assets these students bring with them and the contribution that the students make to our schools and society. We should regard our culturally linguistically diverse students as a resource rather than a problem and affirm the linguistic and cultural capital these children bring to our society and schools. That's Cummings. In the 15 years, the workforce will lose 350,000 workers to retirement. Nationwide, there is predicted to be a shortage of skilled workers, so Twin Cities employers cannot rely on recruiting from other parts of the country. If educational inequities and racial disparities are left unchecked, there will be a reduction in the economic progress the region has experienced. The core cities of St. Paul and Minneapolis have the knowledge economy jobs. 58% are legal occupations, 40% healthcare, and 35% computer jobs. This is from Mind the Gap, reducing disparities. Providing adequate funding to provide quality educational support to ELL students requires an investment in what is proven to be effective in terms of their instruction, will ensure that they are successful, and will provide the economic security that Minnesota needs in the next 30 years. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we have two other testifiers, Mr. Roy Welder, I hope I pronounced that right, from Westbrook, Walnut Grove. So give us an opportunity here from a rural school district, and then Ms. Heidi Bernal from St. Paul Public Schools.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Could you please identify yourself for the record?
My name is Loy Wilbur, and I'm the superintendent of the Westbrook Walnut Grove Schools.
Thank you.
It's nice to be here. It's nice to get out of doing chores for the neighbor in the morning. Our school, I think, has become kind of unique in the area. I think that our neighboring school, Tracy School District and Worthington, are kind of in the same spot that we are. We're just a little bit different in that when I came to the area 6 years ago, that is about the same time that our Hmong population started coming to the area and settling in the Walnut Grove area. And at this point, when I interviewed there a few years back, in 2001, we had 435 students in our little school, K-12, Westbrook and Walnut Grove. Now, last year we peaked at 600 students, and now we're back down to probably about 565. And right now we're about 27% Hmong students in our school, and next year we'll be at about 30%, and we'll probably stay around that, if not grow a little bit more. So it's been a great opportunity for me to be in a rural school district, but get that flavor for the multiculturalism, and I have five kids of my own, and it's a great opportunity for them to interact with a different culture. I have some very good friends that are leaders in the Hmong community and have done a lot for our community. I think the one point that I listed on my little cheat sheet that does come to mind when I say my friends is that I think the one barrier in putting a five-year limit on something like this is that it's no different than my grandparents or anybody else with their language barriers, is that when I go out to the graduation ceremonies or go to the wedding ceremonies or anything like that, there isn't any English being spoken anywhere. And the students aren't speaking it when they're at home. It's just not there. And so that kind of support that we would want them to get at home just isn't going to happen like it is with maybe some of the students that are from the area originally. So I think that we're always going to be, you know, I keep saying I wait a generation where now we're getting our graduates. Some of them are heading off to be doctors, and we're hoping they come back to the Hmong population to help out. But it'll be them helping their kids with their homework. And right now, it isn't happening. We have five Hmong paras in our school, and we have all five helping with parent-teacher conferences just a couple weeks ago. So we line up the conferences, have it all set in because they have to make it a good experience for the parents. So it's just that gap in the family life is what is it's a nice thing, but it's just something that a five-year cap really restricts us. We have our one principal brought up a point. We have the St. Olaf Lutheran Church in between Westbrook and Walnut Grove, out in the middle of the country, 8 miles out. That was founded in the 1880s, didn't stop using Norwegian until the 1930s. And so, I mean, 40 years of, they weren't going to let it go. And we don't want our students to let that go. It's one of those things where they're getting a lot of good help. Our budget this year for our ESL program, LEP program, it's $136,000. And we bring in our revenue, an estimate is probably about $68,000. So we supplement it. We take from general ed, just like special ed. We help the program out because we're not going to say no to these kids. It doesn't matter if it's their sixth or seventh or eighth year. They're still in the programs. They're still getting help. We don't say no to that. So it works out. It works out very well. It's just that we also have four Hmong refugee families that came a couple 3 years ago when St. Paul and Minneapolis got such a large influx too. So it's very difficult to say that here, you know, your clock's ticking. You've got 5 years now, and I can finally get these little fourth grader or the shy eighth grade girl to finally say hi to me and how was your weekend? You've got to search for those words, and it's been 2 years now. I mean, the clock is ticking. So I just I would appreciate any kind of change. I like this bill.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In my district, we have a large immigrant community coming in, and one of the things that we're finding, some of the children that are a little older are not literate in their first language, let alone then trying to get them literate in English as their second language. Are you finding that as an issue as well?
I think we finally realized that with some of our pairs in the school said, it's great, we don't mind interpreting letters for you to send home to families. Problem is, a lot of the Hmong families can't read the Hmong either, the language. So it's, I agree, it is kind of an issue, is that speaking is one thing, but the reading and the writing and all that is, it puts them kind of at a double jeopardy both ways, because they want to hold on to it, but it's hard for them to do well in both.
I see no other questions. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
You have another one, Carlos?
Mr. Chair, I'm just Heidi Burnett from St. Paul Public Schools, and we heard from Mr. Walder the big influx of Southeast Asian community members in recent years, and St. Paul has been very, very much in the front lines of that. We absorbed quite a few students in the past couple of years directly from Southeast Asia. We consider it our benefit, but it does pose certain challenges that this cap really limits our ability to respond to. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Burnett.
Welcome to the committee. Could you please identify yourself for the record?
Yes, sure, we do have a handout too. I'm sorry.
That's fine. Okay. My name is Heidi Burnell.
Buenos dias.
I speak Spanish as well. Members of the committee, Chair Dominguez, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to share our experiences in St. Paul of our ELL students. Research on language learning tells us that it takes between 5 and 10 years to achieve academic proficiency in a second language. The decision several years ago to cap the funding for ELL services at 5 years has had far-reaching consequences for our more than 18,000 ELL students in St. Paul Public Schools, with 42,000 students in all. 18,000 of them are learning English as a second language. St. Paul has by far the largest ELL population in the state, and our ELL programs are nationally recognized for narrowing the achievement gap between English language learners and English proficient students. Our students speak 113 different languages and dialects and come from all over the world. Our largest language groups are Hmong, Spanish, and Somali. We have an inclusive service model that puts ELL teachers in the mainstream classrooms. We don't pull students out for separate service, and we believe that this is the key to our success with English language learners. In addition to the ELL teachers, we provide bilingual educational assistance to all schools to provide additional support for both the students and the families, who, as we were just saying or hearing about a minute ago, most of the families do not speak much English at home. And we actually encourage them to speak their native language at home because we want kids to be bilingual. But we know that learning English is very important as well. I put in the handout that you see a little bit about the funding history of the 18,461 ELL students that we had in St. Paul schools last year. 8,848 of them, or about 48%, were above the funding cap and did not receive any funding. That's huge for us because we do not drop service once the funding is cut. We continue to provide service until students are ready to show that they are proficient in English, which takes, as I said, 7 to 10 years, especially for students who have not been in any prior schooling situation. Some students, as Carlos said, can learn English in 3 to 5 years if they come from a country where they've had schooling and they're literate in their native language. But if this is their first experience, as many of our refugee students are, having the first time that they're ever picking up a pencil, first time they're ever cracking a book open, it takes a lot longer for them to achieve that academic proficiency. So our school district has put up quite a bit of money to help us fund the programs beyond the five-year cap. They've given us $12 million addition dollars for our budget each year. This comes out of our general fund, compensatory, and referendum dollars. And I know that if the funding cap were dropped, that our district would be able to use those dollars in other ways to help other programs as well. We'd expect they continue to support us to some degree, but if the state were funding ELL fully, they would be able to provide money for other programs as well. In addition, some of our schools use their own budgets to provide additional teachers and educational assistance. So we're trying district-wide our best to support the English language learners. In addition, I just wanted to mention that the 5 years does not really mean 5 years. It's 5 years average daily membership, which includes after school and summer school hours. And most, well, I'd say 95% of our ELL students are in after school and summer school programs, taking advantage of the extra time available. But that cuts the funding down to just over 3 years because of the additional hours there. So that is another place where we're kind of put in jeopardy. In the past, our students needed to pass the BST in order to exit ELL services. And in 2005, 64% of the ELL students that took the BST for the first time in eighth grade passed the reading test. 65% of all St. Paul School students that took it for the same at that same time passed. So we, in effect, closed the gap at that point. However, that was the last year of the BSTs, and now students need to pass the Minnesota graduation test, and that's a higher standard. And so the bar has been raised, and we're still trying to get it, but we do need to be providing the service for those students to be able to pass the test. Service doesn't stop just because that funding runs out. We continue to do that. In our elementary grades, as I mentioned, we've got a collaborative model where we have our ELL teachers going into the schools, into the classrooms, to serve the students. We have the two teachers teaching together. Paraprofessionals are also in the mix. In the past, we've been able to staff at a ratio of 1 to 40, one teacher to 40 students. Now we're at 1 to 60, which really decreases the amount of time that teachers are able to spend in that collaborative instructional model. We've also tried to provide professional development for our mainstream teachers as well, because the ELL students are in their classrooms for the bulk of the day, and the ELL teacher's not in there at that time. And so we're trying to provide service professional development for all of our teachers so that they know how to work with ELL students. In the secondary, we haven't had the funding to be able to do that collaborative model. We do provide intensive service for the first few years, and then the students are in mainstream classes where the teachers have some professional development in working with ELL students, but we would like to be able to put additional ELL teachers in there as well, and this funding would support that. In short, the students are going to continue to come. The demographers are predicting that, we're going to continue to get more and more students. We got 2,000 students from the Watt camp 2 years ago. Including those students, we are up 500 students this year from last year. So we're continuing to get more students, and we really need your help and support to make a difference for them.
Thank you for your testimony. We do have a question from one of our representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many different languages or different dialects are you experiencing?
And I believe in Minneapolis, it's probably the same. How many of them?
90.
And Walnut Grove, at least one other with Hmong language, but perhaps some other languages as well.
Well, thank you for your testimony. Representative Mariani, do you have any more information you want to share with us?
At this point, no, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the opportunity to vet this out in the subcommittee here. I think that this is a great opportunity to dive a little bit deeper into this issue. As members know, we started the session by focusing, among other things, on the achievement gap in our state, which is very real. And this issue really goes to the heart of that. A number of students that show up in the educational disparities are going to be students with limited English capacity issues coming into the system. And as you also heard here, it's a statewide concern. I know that in addition to our smaller rural communities, many of our larger regional centers, this is a real big deal. Travel to Rochester, Wilmer, Moorhead, Wilmington, Austin. These are very, very real dynamics for those school districts as their diversity continues to grow. And it just really shows how our state
continues to change a lot. I don't know if you guys remember the movie that came out this summer. I think it was called Beautiful Land, A Beautiful Country. If you had a chance to...
Sweet Land.
Oh, okay. I was thinking beautiful. Because it was a beautiful movie. And I'm really reminded, that movie really, I think, reminds us all that Minnesota really, in many ways, has always been the state of English language learners. We've gone through cycles of that. And so in many ways, we're not addressing something here that is totally foreign or exotic or new to our tradition. You know, raising the cap, members, the cap was set arbitrarily without casting aspersions, at anyone. The point was we were under stress a few years ago. It was set arbitrarily. It wasn't based on sound research as much as it was based on our own sense of stress over the budget. And by raising this cap, it's going to allow us to help schools in very real ways, just as we're also discussing the cross-subsidy issue with special ed. And it's going to allow schools to be what they should be, which are places of learning, and not just places where we're pushing students forward because there's an artificial cap based on our ability to resource the need to provide them with good learning opportunities. So with that, I don't know, Mr. Chair, if there are other members in the audience or if there are other questions for any of the testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. Is there any questions from members? Comments? Is there anybody in the audience who likes to wish to testify on behalf or against? We just want to make sure we get everyone in here. None? I don't see any. Further discussion on the bill. Thank you, Mariani. And would Representative Hillstrom like to renew her motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I will renew my motion that House File 1198 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the K-12 Finance Division.
This bill is passed and recommended to pass on the K-12 Education Finance. And so we'd like to vote on that. One question, Mariani?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just very quickly, I don't have a fiscal note on this bill, and I think it's been moved into Representative Riley's committee. It's appropriate. Is there one? I've not seen one. Since you're a subcommittee of the Finance Committee, you might at least want to look at those numbers very quickly and know what the impact is, or the expectations would be of people.
Thank you for that information. All in favor of the vote, signify by saying aye.
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 All against? Motion carried. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Our next bill is House File 196, isn't it? Oh, 1186, excuse me. Get this right. This is Representative Grady. Welcome to the committee for the very first time.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be here. What a wonderful job you are doing.
Thank you. Well, we're getting along here. This House File 1186. Would someone like to move House File 1186?
Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 1186 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the K-12 Finance Committee.
Representative Hillstrom moves your bill. Representative Grady,
thank you.
Again, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, and members of the committee. Representative Mariani did a very nice job in the last bill talking about the achievement gap and the learning disparities that we have in our Minnesota state education system between students of color and students of varying incomes. This is another bill, like the last one, that would address that achievement gap, and it's a very successful program already up and running, the Collaborative Urban Educator Program, and it's being implemented at Concordia University, in St. Paul, Hamlin University, and the University of St. Thomas. And we have five testifiers, Mr. Chair, that I think I will just leave it at that and let them explain the programs. Each of them are a little different. And then we have a couple of representatives from the school. One of them, Mr. Chair, is North High School.
Well, great.
So
I will leave that up to you to identify them and
all right.
Call them forward.
This is Don Kenix from St. Thomas.
Welcome. Could you identify yourself for the record?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Doug Hennis. I'm Vice President for University and Government Relations at St. Thomas. I'm going to offer some general remarks about the three programs that the state's Collaborative Urban Educator Program has funded over the last 10 years. And then following me, we'll have representatives from each of those programs come up and describe their work. In terms of the programs themselves, Concordia, St. Thomas, and Hamline have developed programs over the last, really, 15 years to recruit, retain, and train more teachers of color and to ensure that younger teachers who are already in the school systems and in urban or urban-like settings are equipped with the skills that they need to be successful. Each of our programs is different. They complement each other. Each meets a specific need, and the goal basically is student achievement. The three colleges, we pride ourselves on making innovations in higher education. The programs we discuss today really do not exist anywhere else in Minnesota. The state's been an important partner in these programs over the years, obviously through its financial support, and we work very closely with the state education department as well as we've developed the programs. And with the individual school districts, as we have sought to determine okay, so where do you need more assistance, where do you need more licensure programs, where do you need more teachers with better training. In recognition of the importance of the program and its success, the governor has, in his budget request, increased the amount of funding that he would like to see to go towards the programs. This biennial, we're funded at a little more than $1 million. He's recommending $1.546 million. So he's recommending on his own a 50% increase. We appreciate the legislature's support of our efforts in the past, and again, we're here this year to request continued support over the next 2 years. We've identified, you know, some new things we'd like to try to do, and we also would like to try to get back to the funding level where we were in the 2001 and 2003 biennial, which was $2.6 million. That, again, would be shared between the three schools. You have an information packet today that includes an overview sheet on the program, a summary of how we've improved student achievement because of the program, and then there's also some background on each of the individual programs and some testimonials. There's finally some national data showing a correlation between having teachers of color in the classroom and improved student performance, and we can provide more information if you'd like it. Now we're going to call up people from each of the three programs. The first two are alumni of the St. Thomas Collaborative Urban Educator Program. Zelma Wiley is a principal at Maxfield Elementary School in St. Paul. She started out as a teacher in the system and obviously has worked her way up. And the second individual is Pao Vu, who's an assistant principal at North High School in Minneapolis. And then when they finish, they'll be followed by representatives from Concordia and from Hamline.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good morning. Good morning, Chairman Dominguez.
Good morning.
Committee members.
Could you please identify yourself for the record?
My name is Zelma Wiley. I'm principal at Maxfield School in St. Paul. I'm very proud to be here representing the Q program, the Collaborative Urban Educator Program. As Doug Hennis mentioned, I am a product of that program and proud to say that I'm also one of the principals in St. Paul schools that has intentionally hired eight of my 24 teachers who have come through the Q program as well as SEET and also Hamline University. One of the things that I think they have brought to the school is a cultural competency that we need as administrators in our buildings to make sure that our parents are welcomed, because they are our partners in closing the achievement gap. Maxfield was an AYP, which means that it was a school that wasn't meeting adequate yearly progress for about 7 years. And with the help of the Collaborative Urban Educator teachers and the SEET teachers that I have, we have proven that the achievement gap can be closed. We are off the AYP list. and I'm very proud of that record. These teachers are competent not only culturally, but have provided our students with high levels of instruction. And I'm hoping that this continues to happen in St. Paul and in the metro area. One of the things that I'm hoping as well is that we continue to see the legislature support us in closing the achievement gap, because we continue to talk about it, and what we need is action and support.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there any other comment?
Well, I am just very proud to be here, because I worked my way through the ranks with the support of Q. I was an ed assistant, and I heard someone mention earlier that they had paraprofessionals in their district who are capable people, but for one reason or another, we needed that support to move up in the ranks, get teacher licensure. And I'm really sincerely hoping that this continues as a practice in St. Paul. We grow our own instead of going out to neighboring states to get teachers that that are able to reach out to our students.
Thank you. Next on your list is, could you say your name again, please?
Good morning. My name is Pao Wu.
Pao Wu, welcome to the committee. Could you please state your name again for the record?
Pao Wu, and I'm the assistant principal at North Community High School in Minneapolis.
All right.
I just have a couple of words to say on behalf of Q, and I just want to say that the program granted me the opportunity to become a classroom teacher and now to serve as an administrator. And I believe the program gave me the tools to work successfully with all students, regardless of color and class. And I would highly encourage you to continue funding the program and all it has to offer to our young people in our communities.
Thank you. Any other comment? Well, thank you for your comments, and you testified. We'll take into consideration. Is there you had a couple others? That
yes, Mr. Chair, there are two others, Sally Bass and Dwight Watson. They can both come forward.
Welcome to the committee.
Buenos dias.
Buenos dias.
I'm Sally Bass. I direct the Southeast Asian Teacher Program, the Hmong Culture and Language Program, and ESL at Concordia University. It's my pleasure to be here today to greet you on behalf of my students. Two of my students were going to be here this morning, but as you know, Friday was a snow day for them. And so when they got to school this morning, their principals were like, oh, please don't go. Please stay here and help us. So I just want to, they both sent to me their letters. One of the letters is in the packet from NAWTA. And NAWTA has been here to speak to some of you in the years past about the Southeast Asian Teacher Program. And she graduated last spring. She is now teaching at Nokomis Elementary. She's teaching ESL. And she is also the lead instructor in one of the programs that we started at Concordia to meet some of the needs that you were talking about earlier this morning in ESL, and that is the Hmong Culture and Language Program. It is a program that grew out of the Southeast Asian Teacher Licensure Program, providing like a lab school for Southeast Asian teachers to teach on Saturdays and during the summertime in a camp for Hmong children to help preserve their language so they are learning their first language of Hmong so that they can better understand and use their second language of English. And so we're working on that problem that was talked about earlier today. The other person that was going to come with me was Vu Thor, and Vu called also this morning and couldn't, and he sent by email a little note. As a student in the program at the Southeast Asian Teacher Licensure Program and Hmong Culture and Language Program at the College of Ed, and as an ESL, he's also studying to be an ESL teacher, I have learned and gained diverse experiences from the classmates and the other professional teachers and the financial support to become a resourceful teacher in the math field is so important to me. I thank you for your ability to help me to go through this program. It has helped me. This is my best and most profound program that I have encountered in my life, which has supported me at Concordia University through my professional education. I wish more teachers of color could come out of this program for the best of the multicultural Twin Cities students, which would improve the Twin Cities' education, economic, social relationships, and businesses for the future. Without the support of the legislature, this program would not be able to continue with the mixed society and would suffer a lot, as stated above, sincerely. So thank you very much for what you're doing for our programs to help our students reach the students out in all across the state. We've been talking a lot about the metro area, but interestingly enough, I spent some time in Forest Lake last week talking with them. They would like to partner with us to have some of our teachers from our program go out to Forest Lake, and they're also interested in providing some financial support. So as you might understand, the legislature provides funding so that pays half of the students' tuition. It pays for their books, and it pays for a laptop at Concordia University. These are for paraprofessionals, EAs, and non-licensed teachers to get their license. So it's providing a wonderful opportunity, and we're not only reaching right within Minneapolis and St. Paul, but we are also reaching out across the state. And that's really important as we read about, you heard this morning from some of the cities that are in great distress. So we're trying to reach out to them. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Sally Vass, for your testimony. And we have another guest, a testifier.
Yes. Good morning.
Would you like to say your name for the
My name is Dwight Watson. And
welcome to the committee, Dwight.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm the interim director of the Center for Excellence in Urban Teaching at Hamline University and the chair of the Education Department at Hamline. Chairman Dominguez and the esteemed panel would like to tell you a little bit about CEUT, Center for Excellence in Urban Teaching. Our goal is to work with urban and urban-like teachers and to provide professional development for teachers that are already in the field. And this is a little bit different from the other two programs who are providing pre-service teacher support. What our job is to go out and to work with people who are novice teachers in their first 2 to 3 years, provide them the cultural competencies that they need in order to be successful in the urban and urban-like environments. And when we say urban-like, we mean that it's not geographically defined by the map of Minneapolis and St. Paul. We have lots of outreach to other school districts that have emerging population of color. So we work in Wayzata and Robbinsdale and Owatonna and Orono and various other places that come to us for our services. What we're finding is that there's an increased population of students of color within the Twin Cities as well as in Greater Minnesota. What we're finding is that there's a decrease in teachers of color. Although the SEAT program and the Q program at St. Thomas are doing their best, and other programs are doing their best to provide pre-service teachers or teachers who have ethnic affinity to the populations that are in their classrooms, there are other teachers out there who are also doing a fine job, other teachers who are not teachers of color, who are out there doing a fine job working with urban-like students. And what we try to do is to make sure that they too have the cultural competency to be successful with all students, or specifically with the emerging populations of color. So the monies that we receive from the state legislature are used to provide professional development for urban and urban-like programs. And it's very necessary because a lot of times when veteran teachers or novice teachers are going through their initial licensure program, they might not pick up on the competencies necessary to be successful with urban and urban-like students. And once they have this emerging population in their classroom, they find themselves struggling. So what we do is we go out and provide professional development for them. And so all of our programs collectively are trying to sort of work with teachers and close that gap. But all of our programs also have their unique emphasis, and our emphasis is professional development for all teachers around urban and urban-like conditions and cultural competency.
Well, thank you for your testimony, Dwight Watson.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there any members like any questions, comments, concerns? Representative McFarland?
Yes, sir. Chair Dominguez, and also this question is for Sally. I forgot your last name.
Boss.
It's okay. Sally Boss.
you commented that the program is pays half of the students' tuition and a laptop. Do any of these students qualify for any additional financial aid, and if so, what percentage?
Holly Boss?
Yes, they do. They apply. Sometimes they are able to get other loans and grants to pay the other half of their tuition, and most often that is the case, but it doesn't pay all of it, certainly. And what we found was when our funds were reduced over the last few years, we went from having 40 students to having 23. So we haven't been able to have as many students go through our program as we would like to, and we would love to see that restored funding so that we could provide that.
Thank you.
Any more questions from the members? Comments? Well, thank you for testifying. Again, we'll take that into consideration. I understand there's other testifiers on House File 1186 that'd like to come forward. Paul Species, I believe it is, and Ron Schultz. Welcome to the committee. Could you please say your name for the record?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Spies. I'm here as a resident of North Minneapolis and a parent of students in North Minneapolis. I want to speak in favor of 1186 because of the tremendous need for diverse urban teachers in our schools. My two children have had 10 teachers while they've been in Minneapolis public schools, and only one teacher of color. I'd like to put that in a broader context of the state. According to the state's teacher ed website, over 10,000 teachers were prepared in 2005-2006 academic year. Only 5% of all the teachers prepared were teachers of color. Contrast that with over 20% students of color in the state, and over 70% students of color in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and we've got a big race gap that contributes to the achievement gap. So I am a big supporter of any efforts to increase the number of teachers of color, culturally, linguistically, culturally competent teachers in our schools. And I just want to publicly state my support for the collaborative urban educator programs that my colleagues work in at St. Thomas, Concordia, and Hamline. And just a personal note, I spoke at the Urban League at the end of the session there and made a plea, and I'm not sure if I mentioned, but the first teacher of color I had was at Morehead State University in my sophomore year in college. And Andrew Conte is a professor of political science from the West African country of Sierra Leone, speaks fluent Russian, political diplomat. He changed my life. So it's not just about students of color in our urban schools. Teachers of color can make a difference in all kids' lives. And I appreciate your support over the last decade. Representative Greiling, thank you for authoring this bill and other co-authors of this bill. Thank you for your support.
Thank you. I should say Dr. Paul Spices. Thank you for your testimony. Welcome, sir. Could you please identify yourself and for the record?
My name is Ronald Olu Schultz. I'm a St. Paul lifelong St. Paul resident and currently a senior at Metropolitan State University. Thank you for having me, committee members and Mr. Chair. I come before you today to request that Metropolitan State University's Urban Teacher Program be added to the list of institutions that receive funding under the Collaborative Urban Educator Program. The Urban Teacher Program at Metro State is one of the only four education programs in the state that focus on training persons of color and other persons to work in urban schools. While I recognize that Metro State already receives state funding, I must point out that it is the only one of the aforementioned institutions that is not getting funding specifically earmarked for their program. Now, tuition at Metro State is considerably lower than at Concordia, Hamline, and St. Thomas Universities. However, that does not mean it is affordable for all. I, myself, am living proof of this. I'm a full-time single parent. I'm a full-time student. I work at Penumbra Theater on a production-to-production basis. I work at Harding High School as a tutor twice a week. I'm also the caretaker of my apartment building. And I hold these jobs to make ends meet, but that doesn't always happen. I've been the recipient of Pell Grants, state grants, and a scholarship from 3M to help pay for my education costs. But again, these funding sources that I am truly grateful for, they have not, unfortunately, been able and enough to cover all the expenses of higher education. And I can assure you I am not the only person in this type of, at best, stagnant financial situation at Metro State. Several of my classmates are also single parents and or are persons of color who would undoubtedly benefit from the additional financial assistance that the Q program could provide to Metro State's Urban Teacher Program. By adding Metro State's Urban Teacher Program to the Q program, you will be expanding support to an educator training and recruitment program whose purpose is to meet the needs of the urban school and diverse student populations. I have chosen to become an urban teacher because I recognize, as do supporters of the Q program, that there is indeed a need for more teachers of color to teach an increasingly diverse student population. I have gleaned valuable knowledge from the core courses in Metro State's Urban Teacher Program, courses that include multicultural education, managing diverse learners, teaching and assessing learners with disabilities, and teaching and assessing English language learners, and I'm certain that this knowledge will enable myself and others to become effective urban teachers. Now, I believe that education to be the foundation of the acceptance of differences, the cornerstone for developing compassion for all human beings, and the key that leads to the equality under our constitutional democracy. By adding Metro State's Urban Teacher Program to the Q program and passing the bill, you will be supporting many more persons of color and underrepresented persons' drive to become urban educators. You'll be showing that you accept differences, that you have compassion for all human beings, and that you also share my belief that education, that the key to equality is indeed education.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. And again, we'll take that under consideration. Any questions from the members? Representative McFarland.
Yes, Chair Dominguez. Ronald, I appreciate you bringing this up. I am in support of this bill, but the question has been coming up in my mind. Are there other public higher ed institutions in the state of Minnesota that do provide this kind of a program? And I guess Representative Reiling has.
Representative Reiling, would you like to respond to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative McFarland, and also to Ronald. I forgot your last name.
Schultz.
Oh, that's an easy one. I am very open to expanding this request to be also for Metro State, and I appreciate your bringing that up, and as Representative McFarland, others have brought that up to me as well. I agreed to author the bill from the three colleges and universities that we're having the bill presented by, and I've discussed it with them. I think it will be a welcome addition to make sure we're including all the schools. It was not an intentional deletion. I also would not want to leave out Metro State. My own son is a student there.
Thank you.
Follow-up question. Are there other public institutions in Minnesota with such programs? Do we know of besides Metro State?
Mr. Representative Brandy?
Representative McFarland, I talked with some people from MNSCU, and I'm going to work with them to make sure we include any. I know Metro State was high on the list, but I believe there might be a couple others.
Thank you. Not sure.
I know that, well, I'll save that for my closing comment. We'll make sure that we are inclusive in this bill.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Members? Well, thank you for your testimony. I see we have another one that wants to testify. Would you please say your name for the record?
I'm Elizabeth Roseborough. I'm a student at Metro State. I'm a candidate of the Urban Teaching Program, and I've come to support the idea that you would consider our program to be a part of the funding, because, as he said, I too am struggling financially, but determined, because I love children and education, all children, all cultures. And I believe that the achievement gap can be eradicated if there are more people of color in the schools. I know that I'm an old lady, but my passion...
Well, I wouldn't say so.
My passion is children and education. And I want to serve in that capacity for the rest of my life. I know that we're living longer now, older people, and I can't wait to spend all those years eradicating any achievement gap, making a difference in their lives, modeling that Minnesota is the greatest state because it can provide teachers of all color. It can give funding to people of all color who are willing to commit their lives to the right purpose. I am very grateful to be here and speak to you about this great university that I'm going to, that makes great strides and has large numbers of urban people of all colors, ages, and languages. They're in our school busy creating the type of teachers we need all over Minnesota to eradicate the achievement gap. But not just that, but to teach all children with a passion. And what they promote is, yes, urban schools, but teach. Be a good, effective teacher. Look how much more they could do if they were a part of this funding. Look how much more people of color and others they could recruit into the urban teaching program. I ask you to please consider our school, our great school, that takes the time for each person, would even spend time with an old lady like me, who some people would not think is worth investing in. Here I am, felt to be a welcome student at that school to live out my passion.
Thank you very much. I'm surely not going to forget you, because with that testimony and my first committee hearing, I'll never forget that. But thank you for your testimony. Representative Greiling, is there any questions of the members, concerns? Thank you. Representative Greiling,
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I hope that you will support this bill. We will work to make it inclusive before too long, and include Metro State and see who else we might be leaving out. And, you know, some of us went and traveled to the Red Lake School last year, I was struck that every single teacher in the school that we were touring, the two schools that we were touring, were all Caucasian. And, you know, with all the problems in that school, it seems that, you know, to have a few teachers that would be Native would be very helpful. I used to teach at J.J. Hill School in St. Paul, and it was, depending on the year, it was before integration. Some of us have had birthdays, and they're getting older and older, and back when we taught it, when I taught it, was before integration, except for my last year of teaching, and we had a lot of African-American students, and I was very appreciative of the teachers of color who were my colleagues, who could help me. We had a lot of Model Cities money then, and training and human resources training, but there was nothing like a colleague who was a teacher of color who I could go to and run things by and find out how I should handle this situation with this student and this family. So I think it's a help to the students as well as all the teachers who are trying their best to address the achievement gap. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Granny. Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 1186 be passed and referred to K-12 Finance, Education Finance Division. All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carried. Thank you, Representative Greiling. Representative Greiling, you have a House File 196.
Mr. Chair, I do. And this one, I understand, we do not, due to logistics of this big bill having to go to so many committees, actually have it in our possession. So this will be an informational hearing, and we'll have to have the actual vote on it in the K-12 committee. So,
Representative Greiling, my understanding is that the House File 196 has been heard at the Mental Health Division and referred to the Public Safety civil justice policy for consideration. Could we hear your bill, Representative Gray?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And House File 196, the only part that we're going to be hearing in the Education Committee is Article 2, Section 5. So if you have, and it's the part on the teen screen. So if you have your bill in front of you, it is on page 11, lines 1 through 6. So it's a very, very short section of this big bill that we have under consideration today, just saying that the commissioner shall develop a request for proposals for grants to implement the Columbia Teen Screen, which is a very well-researched screening for teenagers for depression, anxiety disorders, and substance abuse. And I would, before I turn to our testifier, I just have a couple more things. One, this bill was originally scheduled, Mr. Chair and members, last Monday, and then we were going to have this committee start a week earlier, but then we had all that rules discussion, so that kicked us back a week, and we inadvertently then have this bill up on Mental Health Day on the Hill, and that's where many of our testifiers and people who would like to have been here and heard this hearing are. They're over, you know, training all the citizens who are here to get them informed so they can fan out along the Capitol. So luckily, we pried one of them away, though, who will be testifying in a minute. And then the other thing I would like to underscore, because I know that all the members have been getting a lot of negative emails and other information about this bill, and I would like to strongly underscore that it is misinformation. There's been talk that this bill forces students to be screened, and then they're forced into diagnoses with lifelong implications and medication, and that is very far from the truth. Those are being spread by EdWatch, who needs to update their information. Those things were never true. But there was up until 2004, like the Minnesota Student Survey, the teen screen, where it was offered, was passive opt-out. You had to know that it was coming and ask to be omitted with your own student. But after the controversy from a small number of families, they opted. The teen screen changed their procedure so that it is an opt-in. You have to receive a letter, open it up, read it, and then actively send it back to school. And then the student, even if the parent wants them to participate, also has to agree. They do not know, and unless they have both, if the parent doesn't agree, the student has no ability to participate. And even if the parent agrees, the student has the ability to opt out. Mm-hmm. So I just want to say that very, very strongly for anybody that's confused by the information they would get. I also want to, I don't know if you're going to go over this packet.
Oh, just a moment.
Okay. Andrea Ayers in a minute. I will turn it over to her. But I wanted to have you notice in the packet there's a list of what organizations support teen screen and screening and what organizations do not. And the long list of people who support it are, of course, the mental health professionals and such, but also the American Federation of Teachers, the Psychiatric Nurses, National Education Association, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. But over on the side of who opposes it, I want you to note what three organizations are there. EdWatch, who we all are familiar with here in our state. The Church of Scientology, who we all are familiar with due to the Tom Cruise Brooke Shield incident on television about postpartum depression. They do not support treatment for mental illnesses. And the Eagle Forum. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I just wanted to get that on the table, and then if I would like my testifier to introduce herself and walk us through some of our handouts.
Thank you, Representative Grinding. Before we do that, we have about 15 minutes, maybe 12 minutes. I understand you need to leave early, so just so the
Mr. Chair, the radio calls. I get to be on midday talking about all-day kindergarten. So.
All right.
With the commission.
We don't want to miss that.
No.
Well, thank you for the attending the committee. Could you please identify yourself?
My name is Andrea Ayers. I'm with Family and Children's Service. We're a nonprofit based in the metro area. We primarily provide mental health services to the whole spectrum, from the little ones to the older ones. And we do a lot of school-based interventions with kids that are at risk of getting kicked out of school. We try to get in there and make sure they get to stay in school. We're also a member of the Mental Health Legislative Network. And it is Mental Health Day on the Hill, and all my colleagues are having much more fun over at the church educating people.
You're having fun, aren't you?
No, I think I drew the short straw on this one. So I said, come over here and walk through the teen screen and answer any questions that you people might have. There is a package, Sue Abdeholden from NAMI and I put this together last night for you. It starts off with a letter from Sue, and I will not read that. That won't do it justice, but I would encourage you to read it. The other parts are just some of the basic facts about teen screen. There has been a lot of misinformation going out, not only about this screening program, but mental health screening in general. It does primarily come from the group EdWatch. They simply disagree with mental health screening. Oftentimes, however, they use information that we feel is incorrect. Representative Greiling pointed out a few things. It is an opt-in. There's a copy in your package of the form. Opt-out is not an option. Both the parent or parents and the child have to agree to participate. If the parent wants it and the kid doesn't, it won't happen. Another thing, too, is there's a lot of misinformation that if you screen a child or anybody for mental health issues, that you're going to label them and then drug them. So just to get it clear on the table, screening is really nothing more than taking the mental health temperature of an individual, be it a child or an adult. When you take your temperature for a physical illness, it'll tell you if you have a temperature or not, but it certainly won't tell you what your problem is. You'll go to a professional to figure out if you have strep throat or the flu or whatever it might be. For mental health screening, it's very similar. It's a series of questions usually. With the teen screen, it starts out with a very short questionnaire looking mostly at substance abuse, depression, and anxiety. If they score high enough, if the temperature is high enough, all it indicates is that there may potentially be a problem and you need to look further. So after the child fills out the questionnaire, if their temperature gauge is a little high, the follow-up is an interview with a mental health professional. Again, it's opt-in. If the child or the parent doesn't want to go that far, it's over. If they do want to try to figure out what the problem is, they will engage in an interview with a mental health professional who will then take an even higher temperature with more specific questions and just see, does it look like we have a problem here, or, you know, is it just some typical teenage behavior stuff going on, or what? Once that's done, if the mental health professional determines that we've got maybe a problem here that we need to maybe look at some therapy, some counseling or something like that, that will go back to the parent and child, and they will decide whether or not they want to follow through with any kind of treatment. It's completely opt-in. And at that point, if they do want to follow up and see if there's a problem, then it would go to a full assessment where you may get a diagnosis, and there may be other treatment options, and that would include medications in some cases. But that's kind of how the program works. The screening does not label. It does not lead to drugs. It does nothing but takes the mental health temperature of the individual. And then they choose, just like we choose to go to a doctor, if I have a temperature of 99, I may choose not to go to the doctor. If it continues, I may. It's very much the same thing. It's mental health versus physical health. We like to think of it as they're all the same, but people still like to differentiate, so we'll go there. But that's kind of how it works. I can answer any other questions. In your packet, there are some facts. The Teen Screen program actually has its own website, which is fabulous. I encourage all of you to look at it. And I'm open for any questions.
Any questions of the members? Representative McFarland?
First, I'll start out by saying I support the Columbia Teen Screen. But I'm looking at the parent consent letter. And one thing that kind of popped out at me was that we're not only looking at health, depression, anxiety, but the use of drugs and alcohol. Does this get reported back to the school, this information? There's a little liability issue here when we're finding out that children are using drugs and alcohol. I'm just curious about that.
The way the Columbia Teen Screen works is it is done in schools, it's conducted in schools, but that information does not go into the student record. That information goes to the student and the student's guardian, parent, whoever has signed a consent form. This does not go into student records.
So the
Representative McFarland?
Chair Dominguez. So the counselors don't know about these situations either then, or get alerted to any of these things?
Testifier errors.
The way I understand it is there is a questionnaire that the students fill out. It does have to be scored by whoever is administering the program. So yes, they will see the score. Their job is simply to report the score back to the parent and explain to them what that means. Your child scored high, your child scored great. Here's the next step.
Okay. And this is just...
Representative McFarland?
Yes, and Chair Dominguez. One other part was you said that on the one of these sheets it says where does Teen Screen get its support, and it says it's supported by foundation and local communities. If we as a state were to support this, would the state be also listed as a financial supporter of this program?
Testifiers, do you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to look at Representative Greiling.
Representative Greiling?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McFarland, that's a very good question, and I'm just busy writing it down because I'll have to find out.
Okay. Just curious. Yes. This is the first I had seen the actual parent consent forms packets.
Thank you. Is there any other questions of the committee members? Comments, concerns? I might ask, is there anyone wishing to testify out in the audience? Representative Greiling, would
you? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually, my poor brain is moving and I can have a better answer, but if anyone wants to testify, I can wait.
No, go right ahead. Oh,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McFarland. Actually, when they say that they get their funding from private sources and foundations, the Columbia Teen Screen provides the test to schools and they do trainings. And then the schools, individual schools, and there are, you know, most of the states offer this. We have school districts in Minnesota that already do it, and they aren't listed here. So I think I could answer it by saying, no, they wouldn't be listed, because what they're paying for are their own end of things, not the Columbia Teen Screen itself. There can't be administrators, there can't be teachers that are involved in this, because obviously the confidential nature of the results. But there can be the school support staff that can be involved, or you could bring in outside people. And those are the ones that have to be paid for at the local level. But it wouldn't be contributing exactly to Teen Screen as much as it is the staff at the local level.
Okay.
Sure.
Just to clarify then, so the money that we would be appropriating is going to who?
Representative Greiley.
Mr. Chair, Representative McFarland, it is being appropriate. It's through the Commissioner of Education. It would be going to individual applicants, which would be public schools or family service collaboratives.
Okay.
Representative McFarland?
Yes, could you?
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any other comments from the members? Now, I may ask, is there anyone like to testify? I don't see anyone. Representative Greiling, would you have any final comment?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I would just say thank you very much for listening, and I hope when we get this to the regular committee that this will be included in this bill. I feel that it would do a lot of good also with the achievement gap, because children who are depressed or suffering from anxiety or certainly substance abuse aren't doing their best in school. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Greiling. Thank you, members, and thank you, everyone. I guess I can tap here, say the end of my first meeting.